Show.
Hi, I'm Allison Riley, and you're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Allison Riley, and she's a producer at the Second City here in Chicago who has seen it all. She's been there for 30 years, and she's one of the people who's responsible for casting actors at the Second City. We talked to Allison about how she went from managing a roller rink to working herself all the way to the top of the ladder as a producer at the Second City, what they look for when they are casting and when they are hiring someone, and, of course, I couldn't resist going down a list of all the famous and not-so-famous people that have worked at Second City, along with Allison, and I asked her for an impression or an anecdote or something, which I found to be really fun and also very fascinating. Before we get to that, I just want to say it's good to be back. I feel like in terms of a little disconnected because we're doing these episodes every other week. And the last time I talked to you, I think we were gearing up for Mother's Day, which kind of just put me in kind of a little depression. And I think I'm kind of getting out of it now. But I have a very complicated relationship with my mom. It's very hard to buy a card, a Mother's Day card, because some of them are so loving and flowery and stuff like that. And I just wish, you know, for my mom, I got one. But, you know, what are you going to say? Like, you know, you neglected me when I was a kid, or you weren't there when I needed you. I mean, that's really, that would be honest. But that's not what Mother's Day is about. There's a lot of pressure on it. And also, my mom came over, and Lauren's parents came over, and her mom came over. And even though it was Lauren's first Mother's Day with Betsy there, I felt like the focus was still on our mothers and not Lauren's. And hopefully it'll change. And maybe as Father's Day is coming up soon, maybe I'll get the focus, which, of course, I won't like, and I'll be very uncomfortable with it. But who knows? My therapist said, you know, your Father's Day is coming up. Maybe the focus can go towards you because you're a new father, which I still don't feel like I'm a new father. I really don't. I don't feel like I'm done any parenting yet. I'm just keeping Betsy alive. She's like a plant, you know, make sure she gets water and sunlight, and that's it. All right, enough about me. You don't tune into this podcast to hear about my ramblings. You really don't. You come to hear about great guests, people who give you inspiration and good practical advice to make you a better improviser, a performer. And if you've ever wanted to work at the Second City or the Groundlings or UCB or bigger theaters and comedy theaters, this, I hope, will help you with that. Allison gives you some great insights. She even talks about some myths or rumors about how people get hired. And so she breaks down those in this episode. So enough about me. Here it is, the Allison Riley episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
You know what I love about you? You're a great audience. You really get comedy. How did you become a great audience? Like, appreciate comedy so much?
Well, I started working in the house here at Second City.
For people who don't know, you mean the house?
Yeah. So I did dishes, and I was a waitress, and I was a manager for many years. And then I was the house manager and the general manager for about 15 years. So 15 years I was in the theater. I was watching the shows. I was watching the sets every night. And that's really where my education came in. So I got to see a lot of shows in process. I got to see a lot of sets. I got to see a lot of great failures and tremendous successes. So,
and
being
where,
in the room.
Is like a kid growing up, did you appreciate comedy? Did you like to laugh?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember we used to watch Laugh-In, and the other kids couldn't watch it, you know what I mean? But we would,
because it was kind of considered, yeah, in our generation, kind of dirty.
Yeah, yeah, it wasn't for kids, right. You know. And my father used to go perform at Hull House a couple times, so I went there as a kid.
What did he do?
Yeah, he was in some plays like Take Me Along and The Boyfriend and different things. So I would sit in the rehearsal room and watch them rehearse. And then I started coming to Second City when I was in high school. school. So they would paper the house. They'd give out some free tickets. So I would come during that time and watch the shows. It was really
good.
And you
remember, there was one scene that you remember vividly.
Yeah. I think one of the first scenes that really stands out is Cowboys, and it was George Wendt, Tim Kazarinski, and Donnie DiPaolo, where they play cowboys and they use hair dryers as guns. And it's a very slow scene. It's very funny. And then the gentleman, sans Don DiPaolo, they performed it at the 50th anniversary, and I wasn't really aware that was on that writing order. And they started performing, and then I just started crying because it had been so long since I had seen that scene, and they have them perform like 30 years.
And you, how did you come here? You were working at Rainbow, which was an institution on, yes, Lawrence and Clark.
Yeah, yeah. And it had been Rainbow Gardens before that. It had been ice skating, and then it became roller skating.
They were doing anything just to keep
the doors open. That's right.
And this is like 30 years ago, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
When roller skating was the...
Blondie, lots of James Brown, at the roller rink.
Strobe lights,
okay. Absolutely. A lot of neon, cityscape, the city burning down. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you.
What did people wear back then? Those short shorts, the neon shorts.
Yeah,
shorts?
A little bit that. It was a lot of neighborhood kids, so uh-huh. It was a lot of toughs from uptown. So they weren't fashion forward,
right?
So there was a lot of jeans and t-shirts, mm-hmm. And we had a very adult late night crowd. So I had worked there for about 7 years, and I wanted to get out of there. I was pretty burnt out.
What weird things happened? Was there fights?
There was all kinds of weird thing happened. There were a lot of fights. One night the power went out while all the 25-year-old people were on the roller rink, and so they started playing roller derby in the dark. They climbed over the concession stand and stole all the concessions. The kids would fight. The younger Vietnamese kids would sit up in the balcony and gamble. You know, so it was a constant.
Did you have to like confiscate liquor and pot and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, they would do that out in the parking garage before they came in, so that was pretty good. But yeah, I confiscated a laboratory quality electronic scale where people about to cut up some grams in the bathroom. Right. And I was like, oh, ladies, you know, you can't plug that in here. I'm going to put it in the office, and then when you leave, I'll give you back your scale.
So when you think about it, working at Rainbow was really was good experience for here.
Absolutely. But when I came here, the people were, you know, you'd say to the line of people, sitting, if you could move to the left, and everybody would step to the left at the same time, there nobody would listen to you. You were always fighting a bigger
fight. But I remember, like early on, it was probably the 80s, mm-hmm. the cast could be kind of,
yeah.
Allegedly would come into the bar and drink at night and stuff like that.
Yeah, we had some good late night parties, that's for sure. And during that time, I wasn't managing them. Kelly Leonard was tasked with managing them. So, you know, Andy Cobb, when he first came to Second City, he would grab all the guys' balls. And so we didn't know that he wasn't housebroken. So I'm like, you have to talk to your guy about grabbing people's balls. He has to stop. And so he had a conversation, and he was only allowed to grab Kelly and Andrew's balls. So a lot of people had to get housebroken once they came here to Second City.
Yeah, I mean, it could, you know, and a couple nights ago, Jeff Garland was on, yep, Colbert. Did you see that?
No, I heard about it.
Okay, so he's on, and it had to be the time that you were working.
Yeah,
you
absolutely. Were
so both Jeff Garland and Stephen Colbert worked at the box office.
Yes.
What do you remember about those guys?
That Jeff Garland is a terrible box office employee. He would do like, he'd pick up the phone and be like, the puppet show, you want tickets for the puppet show? It's got little kittens in it. Or he'd pick up the phone and hit the button and just kill off all the calls at once. So he wasn't really conscientious about taking reservations. Stephen Colbert, being the perfect gentleman that he is, was much more conscientious. And he sold t-shirts for a long time. And for like 5 or 6 years, he had the record of selling like $1,700 worth of t-shirts in one night. He's a great guy.
What do you think the secret of his success is?
He's so intelligent. And he works so hard. His mind, you know, anything that if he wanted to be a great lawyer or a doctor, he could have done any of those things. We are lucky that he decided to be a great comedian. And you know what I mean?
Now, we were talking just before we go on backstage about how much time he really put in. Right. Because I think people, they look at him and like, oh, I want to be Stephen Colbert.
Yeah.
But tell us how hard he worked to get where he is today, here.
Well, Yeah, and we were talking about that people don't stay in Chicago for 7 or 8 years to get to a stage now. Now they're here 3 or 4 years. They leave. They go to L.A. They want to move through the ranks as quickly as they can, which I understand, but it takes more time than that. So you look at somebody like Stephen Colbert, who would have put a couple years in the touring company, would have gone out to Northwest and done shows.
Which was another—it's no longer, but that was another resident company.
Yep, Second City Northwest. He would have gone out there and done shows there. He would have come to—he understudied— He would have come to the main stage and done several shows. So by the time he's leaving here, he's been here 9 years. You know what I mean? And he's done he has a tremendous amount of work and things that he's created for the stages. So he's really honed his skills during that time.
And the other thing is people don't understand Steve Carell was the same way. I mean, people would be like, oh, when is he, you know, he did so many shows, reviews here, people are like, oh, when is he going to leave?
Right,
you know?
Right.
But I mean, each show he was still contributing,
right.
You know? And I think that, how much do you think that attributes to people's success going, you know what, I'm going to do 4 reviews?
Absolutely, because they become better writers, better editors. They hone their voice. But the other thing is that people have a lot more access to put their voice out there sooner, right? So you can go to the internet. They couldn't put up their own internet show. They couldn't have gone to LA and started writing for cable because they weren't looking for as many people then. So yes, get your reps, but people don't want to put in. They want a little bit more immediacy. I think they don't. They want to be seen in a bigger context. So they're putting more stuff up on the web.
And that creates kind of an interesting thing for you to deal with because, I've told you this, people we've had on the main stage, they are represented now, before they even leave Chicago, they have L.A. managers and agents.
Mm-hmm.
And you're telling me that it's also happening in the touring company.
Yep.
So if that's the case, that is your farm system. So how do you pick people for the resident company when people are being pulled to either coast?
Yeah, it's... they have to want to stay here, and they're always being wooed by their agents and managers, and people are still being wooed by L.A. even if they don't have a representation. They know that they're going to go there at some point. You know, you had Chris Redd on, and he talked about making the decision. We had cast him for ETC. He was 3 or 4 weeks into the process. He couldn't pass up a great offer from L.A., so he chose to go to L.A. instead of do a show. So that's a hard conflict, and we want you to finish a process if you're here. We want you to open your show, and then what happens afterwards? I can't keep you. I would love for you to do 2 or 3 shows, but sometimes that's just not going to be your plan.
The other thing is you when you got here, Joyce Sloan was the producer.
Absolutely.
And what did you – and she was great. What did you learn from her?
Well, I think she was a true fan. She was a true fan, and she would rally behind you and support you and give you pretty honest insight into where she thought you were. So I think that's valuable. You want somebody who's going to give you some real input onto what you should be doing, where you're landing in the system, if you want to call it that. And she was a true fan, and she would root for you, you know, and she would get on the phone and take some action for you and really help push you along. So...
how could you be one of Joyce's favorites? Because that was always the thing. People would be like, oh, I'm not one of Joyce's favorites.
Well, get up to speed on the Cubs.
shop at the resale shop.
Go to the movies with her. You know, Fran and Rosie, Fran Adams and Rosie Abdu used to go to the movies with her all the time. Well, I think you just had to be really funny and hardworking. She so wanted you to take it seriously and love it and have a great time.
I never worked one of the stages here, but I always felt I was one of her favorites.
Oh, sure.
She was always, she would always make time for you, especially when she was producer emeritus, to talk. And,
right.
And I really think that that really added a lot of years to her life when she became producer emeritus.
Absolutely, because she's still here in the theater that she loves, with the people that she loves, doing the work, seeing the shows. So such an important part of the community in terms of network building and a touchstone for so many people about what the work is, what it should be. People would come in, new people would come in, and they talked about, you know, I loved Bill Murray, you know, he's my hero. And then she'd start telling you Bill Murray stories about, or I love Belushi. And so she knew all those people, so she could access those stories for you. She could even access those people for you.
Well, see, that's the thing that I don't think people realize. You have that same history now because you've been here for 30 years.
Yes.
And that's really important. We were talking backstage about how important it is to understand the history of not only this place, but of improv in Chicago. Why is it important to understand the history?
Well, it gives you a foundation. It's like anything. You need to learn the basics, right? So you want to have that foundation. You want to know where do these games come from? Who broke the form? Who pushed this forward? What's interesting to me? How can I use this to create in different ways? How can I use improv to create for the page, you know? So I think it's great to have mentors that you can go and access and talk to about this and learn directly from them. Now we're, you know, we've lost a lot of the founders. We lost Bernie and Joy and Sheldon, who I love so much. We've lost those founders, so it's for us to carry on that message to other people.
What did you love about Sheldon so much?
Oh, Sheldon was such a tremendous fan, and he would come and laugh at the show. So a lot of times people would come and watch the show, and they won't really laugh, but Sheldon would laugh so hard at the show, and he would come back and give great notes and be so supportive of the cast, and he just really loved them and loved their work.
So now, you as a producer... Yeah. What is fun about this job?
Well, getting to go into the room and see new material, hiring people for their dream job.
Tell me about that hiring. When you hire somebody, do you call them up on the phone? Do they come in person?
We would like them to come in person. Sometimes they might be somewhere off in the universe, and we need to reach out to them immediately. We'd bring the... Hopefully the director would come in. So the director would come in my office.
Do they know why they're coming in?
They're hoping. I don't call you for meetings too often.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So if I call you
If you call my house, yeah. It's because you're going to hire me.
No, absolutely
okay.
not.
All right.
Because we're going to get lunch and then I'll see the baby.
Right. All right, so let's say you called me in. So yeah. how would it go?
I'd be like, hi, Jimmy, how are you?
How's it going? Hi, Allison.
Good. Good to see you. You know, we really have been enjoying the work you've been doing.
Well, thank
lately.
You.
You know, yeah. You've been, you know, we love what you wrote for the Christmas show and the touring company.
Thank
you're really
you, yeah.
killing it, and you've grown so much here. Mm-hmm. And on behalf of Second City and Matt Hovde, I'd like to join you, ask you to join the resident stage of the main stage.
Okay, can I ask my wife? My baby's sleeping right now.
Okay.
My wife's, when she comes back, I'll get back to you.
Yeah. You forgot the part where you start crying.
Okay. Has anybody ever said, can I think about it?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. And people said, I can't. I can't do it right now. I have other commitments. I have other things. I've made other promises in my life. Absolutely. We've been refused.
Okay.
Absolutely. But usually, you know, they've worked so hard. This is their dream. This is their dream job. You're so thrilled for them. I'm as thrilled for them as they are for themselves, because people come to Chicago and they learn to improvise and they spend years honing this craft with no promise of anything ever happening. And I have such respect for that, and I'm so in awe of the commitment that people have to this work. And so when you bring somebody in and you say, your work is being recognized, you are getting the job that you've always wanted, we have faith in you, we are excited by your voice, you need to come to our stage, we want you to showcase who you are in this format, I mean, that's amazing.
And so much has changed, I think, in terms of voice on, mm-hmm. on these stages. And you're looking for people that have very strong points of view.
Yes. Or also can bring it forward in a comedic way, or somebody who's such a good comedian that they can make any scene better. They're always going to make a scene better. They're always going to lift it up.
Now I think, more than ever, we're seeing there's more diversity than I remember in the 80s.
Absolutely.
You know, and we're getting a lot more diverse points of view. How does that all work together? Because I would imagine in some casts, not everybody is going to agree with everybody's point of view. So how do you have them all play well together? Because everyone's point of view is needs to be honored.
Absolutely. And I think usually you find people are in support of the other person's point of view, even if it's not exactly theirs, that they will support that. And that's something the director has to negotiate, right? And people will write, too. So I would write a scene for you. I would write a scene, and I would include you in the scene, and I'm asking you to support my scene. And maybe you're going to play the villain in the scene. Maybe you're going to be, you're not going to be shown in such a good light. But I'm looking for you to commit to that, you know? And so that might be a conversation, and that actor might say, I'm not really comfortable playing this role. I don't want to portray myself this way. I don't, you know what I mean? So that's a conversation that the actors have to work on together to support each other in the work they want to do.
Do you ever have to get involved in those conversations?
No. And hopefully I'm not really involved in the process. By the time I am hearing or in some way getting involved in the process, things have kind of gotten off track or there's been issues.
And tell us about the rehearsal process, because you say that this is like, this is where the rubber meets the road.
Right. And nobody else really kind of, we found that Hubbard Street, the dance company, that they do a lot of improvisation, and this is a way that they generate their dances. And so it was a good collaboration for us. But who else has, 12 weeks to test material? So we hire the best cast that we can. That is so important, to hire a great cast.
And what are you looking for when you hire somebody?
Well, you're trying to get the best of the best, and you're trying to meet a lot of needs. So who's a great political writer? How funny are they? Who wants to sing and write songs and bring that work forward? How satirical are they as a group? How can they turn their voice into satire? Have they mastered that skill? Can they write on paper? Are they brilliant improvisers? Are they funny? So all of those things, and so you're looking at, maybe you have two cast members who are returning, you're looking at their skill set and what they bring, and you're thinking about what you need to create a full ensemble to create a great show.
All right, the psychological part of this, because you've said that process can make you crazy, mm-hmm. right? The rehearsal process, because mm-hmm. it's 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. How much do you put into this guy has everything, or this woman has everything, but you know what? I don't think she's a team player, or I don't think he's a team player. How much is that?
Well, there have been people that have not been asked because other people do not want to play with them, or they don't play well, or their association with two or three members in a cast. You just feel like it's not going to work, and why are you setting yourself up for failure? And why are you setting, if you could wait another show and that person could go in another show and there wouldn't be that kind of conflict, that's the better scenario. Why are you setting the other act? Because you have to protect the actors from each other, too, in a way. You want them to be in the safest space that they can be in. If you know people have open conflicts, or somebody's a shit starter, right?
How do you know that?
Well, you know that from they've been on the road, word on the street, problems that they've had in their classes, So this conversation around casting goes on for, 10 weeks before we actually cast people. And it's talking with the director about who they're interested out. There's going out and seeing people. There's talking to their former directors. There's making up all kinds of scenarios of different casts that you want and how would that work. And so there's a lot of thought that goes into it. And you have knowledge of these people before you even
start. So how much power do you have in those casting sessions? Take me to the casting session.
Well, I think that there's the director and I have been talking for weeks now. We have all kind of gone out and done some research, and I think
when you say research,
well,
what do you mean?
Well,
go to shows?
We've gone and seen them in shows. We reached out to former directors, maybe their touring company director. We hopefully have seen one of their shows that they have done their own show. We're going to talk to the other producers around the building and find out what they think about them. We might reach out to our artistic consultants, talk to them, trying to get some history. Can they write? Are they a writer? What's their political point of view? Do they write on paper? Do they write on their feet? Can they re-improvise? So we're getting all this information, and we're getting excited about people. So that's the mark of when when you're like, that's a great cast. I'm excited about that cast being on stage. You never want to be like, I don't know, or maybe not. No, you can't. You have to be excited about them coming to the stage, and you have to be excited about what that group is going to bring. You're trying to cast that group for that show.
Okay, so let's talk about, and I don't want to get into the specifics, because so the ETC show, the Red Line or whatever,
mm-hmm, the Red Line runs through,
kind of the cast blew up, yep. Basically, right? How do you go now rebuild from that? What's your strategy?
Well, you look at the cast members who are returning. You think about mm-hmm. their skill set. You get really excited about the next group of people that you're going to bring in, and you're trying to what show do you want? What time is it? Is it political time? Are we everything? It's always going to be a political time from here on out.
at least for the next 3.5 years.
Yeah, it's never going to change
right
now. Who are you excited to work with? Who's shown growth? Who feels powerful that can go on that stage? Who's a great calming presence? Who's a great leader, And how much that factors in depends on who you have, what I mean?
What did you learn from the ETC experience
as
a producer?
Well, I think that, first of all, what an amazing show they put up.
Yeah.
They put up a fantastic show mm-hmm. With their director. So thrilled about that. So you feel like you did a great job casting the right people to bring the material together and to put their very diverse and very smart point of view up on stage. So that part was achieved. Mm-hmm. It's really hard with interpersonal relationships. Mm-hmm. You can't foresee how the process is going to affect them or what's going to happen during the process where after it's over, they carry a lot of resentment and don't like each other, or people have their own personal issues. So it's really hard to know. So what did I learn? I would like to have known sooner and intervened quicker.
And what would you have done?
I don't know. I think that we would have brought more people into the room to have a bigger conversation about what was going on.
Because I would imagine from your point of view, it's disappointing because you have this great show as a producer. It's getting great reviews, and then it kind of falls apart.
I think the biggest disappointment is you had great performers, great comedians, great actors up there, and it affected the trajectory of their careers. And that's a failure. That is a failure. And you want to support them better. You want to protect them better. You've brought them into this. This is the last thing that you want for them. This is the last thing for them to walk away from the show, to go to another show earlier than you wanted to. That's exactly what you don't want to happen.
You care so much about the people. How important is that to be a good producer? Because when you think about it, I know it's changed a lot, but there was always kind of a tension between producer and talent.
And there always will be.
What is that tension?
Well, it's the minute you put a monetary number on my art, right? And the minute that you meddle in my art, because there's the crucial moment a lot of times in process is funny, is you're writing your own show, you're doing your own art, you're in there with your director, I'm randomly on the periphery somewhere, you're all a group, and now I'm asking you for titles. And so you have so much ownership of...
Well, you mean titles for the show. Which is a headache for you.
Well, and it's also thrilling too, right? You get these amazing titles.
Right.
But
I give you two at a time.
Yeah,
you know.
You're trying to dole them out to me. I want 12. You're like, here's two. I'm like, no, give me more. And so this is the moment at which the producers take over and start to put their hands on your art. They choose a title for you. They put imagery behind it. They start to market it. And this is always going to be where there's an issue. You know what I mean? And I don't blame them. You know, I want the funniest, smartest, shortest title I can get, you know, and they want to have, what was their Studs Terkel's Not Working title, you know? And, you know, you're like 90% of the people who have no idea who Studs Terkel is.
Do you get a lot of anger? Like, do actors, like, throw a lot of anger your way?
No, I don't think they throw anger. You know what I mean? And that happens in the room.
Right.
So the director's protecting all sides from each other in that moment. Yeah, they're not necessarily angry. And the director will say, these are their three favorite titles. You know what I mean? I'll be like, great, can I have eight more titles? You know, so that conversation happens a lot.
The other thing you said, I think it was interesting when we talked before, you think it's very important not to try to get hired by Second City, not to try to change your voice, not to think like, what does Second City want? Why is that?
Because when you're improvising, you're showing who you are. It's your voice. It comes through. Everybody sees an actor. They're like, oh, I love that actor. I don't know why, but I just really like them. Or I don't like that. That's them coming through. You know what I mean? So when you're improvising, you're really sharing your voice, your experience, your outlook. You know what I mean? And when you start to think about that, number one, you're affecting your improv. You're not really true to yourself on your feet. You're not going to have the immediacy. You're second guessing yourself. You're second guessing yourself. And you have to back your own play. If you can't back yourself and your point of view and really lean into that, it's going to feel hollow. It's going to feel hollow. And you know what? My worldview is boring. I know what my worldview is. I want to hear a different worldview. I want to hear somebody else's life experience. You know, that to me is fascinating.
So what are the myths? I know you and Beth Kliegerman speak to the students, and there's myths about getting hired at Second City.
Yeah, and different ones come up at times. Some of them are like, you have to go on a ship in order to get a spot at Second City. You have to, you know, the way you get a stage is you have to quit touring company, you know what I mean? Don't work on the bar staff. They won't take you seriously as an actor.
One that which must not have been true is they said don't work in the box office. Because if you work in the box office, they're only going to think of you as someone who works in the box office. Right. And they'll not consider you for one of the stages. Yeah.
T.J. Jagodowski was the receptionist for a long time, and he's done pretty well. Talent wins out. Mm-hmm. Talent wins out. If you're the funniest and best and smartest improviser, we will want you. We will find you. We will see you somewhere. We will hear about you in the community, and we will want you. And then if you're mopping the floor, then we will come and get you and tell you, quit mopping the floor. Why don't you go on tour, or why don't you understand the touring company?
The other thing, and this goes way back to the 80s, I don't know if they still do this, and it used to just drive me nuts. You would all audition for the touring company, mm-hmm. and they would hire the people, and then they would have a list. Do you remember this? They would have a list, and you were on the list. Does that list still exist?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell me about it? Because it would drive me nuts. Because those people never got hired.
Well, that's not...
Okay.
Some of those people on the list might not go to a resident stage.
Okay.
But, here at Second City, we're doing two auditions a year. But
when's the next one?
I think in August coming up, right? So general audition, it used to be that we'd see about 500 people in a week. Out of those 500 people, we would call back 30 people. And out of those 30 people, maybe we would put on a list or hire 12. Two of those people might go into a Patchco right away and start doing some work. The other people we would reach out to over the course of the year and say, hey, great, we got a Patchco gig for you, or you're going to understudy this person in the touring company. So over the course of year, we're trying to bring those 12 people or 8 people that we put on the list or the bench or wherever. We keep them in a closet. We try and integrate them into the system and get them working.
So the list, if you do get on the list today, it's...
Yeah, we're trying to get you working. Yes.
Great.
Are you still on the list?
I am.
You should check.
I never got on the list.
You never got on the list?
Yeah. I blew it. I had opportunities to be in a touring company, and I blew it. Okay. And there's two that I think about. One was Scott Ullman. You remember Scott?
Yeah.
I was working at the Business Theater, and he said to me, hey, let me go and talk, because the Business Theater was doing corporate stuff. Mm-hmm. Let me talk to Kelly Leonard for you. And I'm like, I think I was 30. And I'm like, no, I'm too old to tour, which was a stupid thing.
Yeah.
And before that, when all my peers like Brian Stack and Koechner got hired, Kelly Leonard had just become the producer. And I wrote a letter going, Kelly, I don't want to work at Second City, which was not true at all. I was just self-sabotaging myself. So I am still open
to be.
I'm still open.
That's good.
And I've said, really, Allison, I would love to know your opinion on this. There's a lot of people in the audience that come to Second City mm-hmm. that are 53 or they're in their 50s. They have kids, maybe not as young as my daughter, Betsy. But I think that I could represent. Imagine throwing somebody who's 53, his wife just had a baby, on the main stage. Wouldn't he be the voice of the audience today? I just want you to think about it.
Okay, I'll think about
it. I'm not pitching you. I just want to think about
it. Okay, I'll get back to you on that. I'll think about it for a while, and then I'll get back to you.
But wouldn't I represent
a different voice, a different generation?
Well, and age is interesting.
I
think they talk about, everybody talks about, but ageism exists in improvisation. Because if I went to an audition for the touring company, I'm better than that now, I think. But if I went to main stage or ETC, I don't know if I would be even considered because of my age.
Right, and it's a little like baseball. Maybe you age out at some point, or it's a younger person's game, or we're looking for a younger point of view. It has always been a generational. Different generations have come to the stage. You know, sometimes comedy has like a 10-year window. You know, you'll see like a stand-up, and he's really the voice. She's really the voice for that 10-year period. You know what I mean? And they can really bring that forward in a way that somebody who's 60 can't speak for that generation. They speak for a different generation. And I think it would be interesting to have a show with people who were, you know what I mean, over 29. And hear their voice, and I think it's really valid. And now that we're having more improvisers who are older than that, maybe somebody will put that together.
So you're basically saying I'm too old.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
I didn't say that.
Okay. I'm saying that. We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back
after this.
So we'll open it up for some questions and answers.
Yep.
Okay. I hope I haven't been too hard on you.
Oh, no.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay. All right. So we're going to, so do you want to start with a question?
Right. Well, and some of the people that are on the stages are older than you think, right? And so,
what is the average age, you think, span?
I don't know. Well, a lot of people are getting into their 30s, you know what I mean? So you have to be the best and the funniest. I mean, that's the truth of it. And if you're the best and the funniest in the room, and that fits into that ensemble, and the director's really excited about you, they're going to campaign for you, and they're going to want you. And there have been some people who have been, we would think, past their time and not getting a spot on the resident stages, and they've gotten one because directors have really wanted to work with them. They love their skill set. They were great writers. They had great points of view. So I would tell your classmate they're not producing and they don't get to make that call. So I would just keep putting my work out there.
But this is kind of the whole myth, you know, the rumor mill that people throw out there that I think sometimes can obstruct people, you know, pursuing stuff.
Well, and then there's going to be a point in your life where if you've come here and you've auditioned five times for the general auditions and you've spent 5 or 6 years here and you haven't made any headway, that you're going to have to make some decisions for yourself about what you want to do with your career. And that's the truth. And I think it's that's true for all actors at some point. If you're not getting anywhere, if you're not getting auditioned, if you're not getting on a team, you have to take a look at what's going on, and maybe you're getting more assistance or different classes, you know, but how do you want to handle that?
You know, the other thing that I was true in my generation, I don't know if it's changed, but people would audition for Second City and they wouldn't get in. And as soon as they went out and they did something, put up a one-man show or a one-woman show, or they got cast in a play or something, then Second City would come to look to them, and their stock would rise, and they would eventually get hired. Is that still a good strategy if they've auditioned several times and they're just not getting noticed?
Going out and doing great work with great people and getting more reps is always going to be a good idea, right? If you have the hottest show in town, you know what I mean, and everybody's going to see it, you know, you're extending for weeks, you have a great voice, you've presented your material in a unique way. Who doesn't want to see that and go out there and talk to that person and possibly bring them in? Yes. And you've grown. That's what's happened. It's not that you've left Second City. You've grown.
I also think you've let go. If you can let go, we've had so many people, I'm just thinking Brian Stack, or where they literally said, you know, I gave up, you know, I didn't think I was going to get it. And, you know, a month later, you get the call from, at that time, probably Joy Stone saying, you've got the job.
Yeah, and there is something to be said. It's like pursuing a lover who doesn't, an unrequited love, and then once you go away, all of a sudden they're like, why aren't you pursuing me anymore, you know? But I think the truth of that is that you've grown. You know what I mean? You've gotten past it a certain way. You've learned the lessons that you could learn at Second City at that time. Now you need to go out and do the work, because really you can take lessons and be in class, but you have to be out there doing the work. You have to be out there for a real audience, not your friends, getting paid and really learning how to work with an audience and a crowd and really getting those real reactions to know where your material's landing.
There was another thing in my generation that they talked about was schmoozing, which was make sure you go to the main stage show. Make sure you go to the touring company show. Make sure that the people that are doing the hiring know you. Is that still true?
sure, you want to have a face before the producers, but not in a smoozing way. You're actually generally, yes, you should be seeing the main stage in ETC shows. That's what we do here. You need to know what that work is. And yes, you should see the touring company because you want to get that job. You need to know what it is. It's not because you want me to see you sitting on the bench taking notes. It's because you want to do it. And you know who those people are. You know, come on. I've been around a long time. We know who's schmoozing me and who's really there to watch the show. I figured that part out.
What is it?
I don't schmooze so easy.
Okay,
easy.
What is a red flag for someone who's schmoozing you?
Schmoozing me. Well, they're around or dropping by. People don't schmooze me too much. That doesn't
really.
No.
That's kind of a lost art.
I think some of it is interesting because I think some of it's proximity. I think when Joyce was downstairs and people rehearsing in the main stage, it was a smaller group of people. You could drop in. If you want to smooze the producers, you got to come upstairs and be randomly wandering around the hall. You know what I mean? Or catch us at lunch.
Yeah. I would say like bringing you a gift of something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Does that happen?
No.
You're kidding me.
No. I will take gifts, but that doesn't mean anything.
Okay, so if I was going to bring you a gift, what would I bring you?
Some like a nice chocolate.
Okay.
Nice chocolate.
The other thing that's changed at Second City is the signs now that are in the lobby before you go into the show.
Mm-hmm. So that was born a little bit out of Redline and the frustrations the cast had back there with audience members' reactions to some material. And they put up some very personal material. Very personal. So you're here, you're writing a show, we're asking for the innermost you. We want you to be brave and take risks and be fearless. I think of Susan Messing whenever I say fearless. I always do. Susan Messing, fearless. Right. And so you're creating and doing that work and you're bringing it out to the stage every night and you're not anticipating the response that you're going to get from the audience. And it becomes very personal to have them reject your material. And maybe they're rejecting it by making faces, just kind of cringing in the audience, or maybe they're saying things under their breath, but you can feel them pulling back and pulling away from you. And maybe some people are saying things like gross or ugh or I don't like that. And it's a really painful personal rejection to take every night. And then you also have the drunk loudmouths who are going to say, I don't like that, or that's horrible, or you know what I mean. So it became, before the election, when all that was going on, people felt emboldened to share their views about everything on the stage and how they felt about it, as opposed to quietly sitting and accepting someone else's point of view. So it became difficult for them to do the show. It became difficult for us to police maybe the grimacing faces in the front row. And a lot of that was born out of a need to try and protect them in some ways and to let the audience know that that's not okay. You don't get to speak every thought that you have in your mind. You can't be ignorant or racist or yell things out. And the cast can't be afraid of the audience is the other thing. So we put up some signs in retrospect. And how do we feel about them now? I think that the material has also left the stage, so that's changed a little bit of the dynamic. And the audiences, it's funny because when the main stage show opened, Winner of Our Discontent, people thought it was maybe a little too straightforward in its opinion about Republicans. But over time, as we've seen Mr. Trump be as horrible as we could possibly imagine, people have embraced that show more and agree with it more. And so it's changed the dynamic.
So
in the room.
One of the criticisms of that sign was it was political?
Well, a little bit, yeah. Yeah, it's a little political. You know, us
leaning towards the right?
Well, in terms of, you know, you soft snowflakes, you know, you can't take any criticism. You know, why are you silencing the other side's voices? It's a form of censorship, you know.
What do you feel about Stephen Colbert? You heard about him.
Yes.
Because that seems like kind of on the same.
Yeah, it seems like a tremendous overreaction, tremendous overreaction to a sentence. You know what I mean? And he's doing great. He's got great ratings. I think he's found his voice on that show.
Yes.
And yeah, he's, you know what I mean? So that makes me excited and thrilled for him.
Yeah, we'll take another question. Yeah, sure.
Purpose is to speak truth to power and to shine a light on hypocrisy. It seems that as a society, to that? Like, how do you see satire's role changing given the current political climate?
Well, we need it more than ever. I think it's a great way to get across your point of view and maybe win some hearts and minds. It's the kindest way sometimes to let people know how you feel and that they're misinformed. And true satire, you know what I mean, is a very difficult thing to bring forward. I think on the stages, you'll see sometimes you'll have two or three great satirical pieces in the show and some things that land softer. But I think it's really important. I don't think that we want to stifle those voices at all. I think that people are a little bit, they don't want to couch things in satire anymore. People are really angry, so they're just pushing past that and putting their voices out there in a very pointed way.
In the whole idea of political correctness that seems to always be a conflict, and like how far can you really go and stuff like that. How is a producer, how do you navigate that?
I feel like that's gone away. And you know what I mean? I don't think that we are being politically correct anymore. I think that's somehow become in the past, and that people are really putting their point of view out there, that they don't want to mince words, that they're not going to hedge what they want to say. They're going to be very direct about it, you know. But is it funny? You know, it needs to be funny for the stage. And we don't want to censor the actors, what they have to say.
And so has it ever come down with, like, someone's hitting it over the head too much and it's not funny, and you have to say as a producer, well, I understand your point of view, but this isn't funny, or you need to find the funny in this,
right? Well,
because if you lose that, it loses its effect, right?
Absolutely. And that's a conversation I would have with the director. You know what I mean? It's not funny anymore. They've lost the funny in it. It's too on the nose, or you need to protect that better. Can you put it somewhere else in the show where if they don't want to change the way they're saying it, if they really want to make a point that way, can you protect it in the show so we can actually hear it and take it in?
And when you say protected in the show, if you mix it in the running order,
yeah,
if you put it farther down in the running
right.
order, it may protect it,
yes,
versus starting it off in the
yes.
show where people might just, you know, mm-hmm. be offended by it.
Yeah, if you get to know that actor and the characters they do and really like them, it's a lot easier to take a dose of medicine from them.
Let's take one more question. Yes.
Hi,
Austin. Hi, David.
David's been here for how long?
Six years?
Yeah.
I'm a big Pat O'Brien fan.
Can't stand him.
And I'm wondering, is there an inside or a backstage story or like a casting story that you can tell us about Pat?
Oh, Pat. We love Pat so much. Well, here's something about Pat. Pat did a one-man show, and Kelly and I went and saw it, and we were laughing so hard we were slapping the table. And we never found out anything about Pat O'Brien during the course of that show. So it wasn't a personal show about Pat O'Brien. It was just funny, 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 funny. And he did a great job, and that was one of the major reasons that he got hired. You know, obviously he's really talented. Pat O'Brien, right? So we love Pat O'Brien. Pat O'Brien likes to be naked backstage a lot. And would try and hug you when you're completely naked. And he did.
Now today, That wouldn't play, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit harder to do that because his other castmates were just rolling their eyes, like Mary Sohn was like, ugh, you know what I mean? So now we would encourage you to put your clothes on. You could, you know.
Similar to Andy Cobb grabbing people's balls.
Yeah, yeah, we would encourage you to stop. It's a little different.
Right.
But Pat did a scene with Shelley, where Shelley Gossman, where he proposed to her every night on the main stage. And he did such an amazing job. They did such an amazing job.
A little backstory. They
dated.
They dated.
Right. And he would break the fourth wall in the scene and propose to Shelley. And it would stop the show. And people would argue, and they would call the next day, and they would want to know if that was a real proposal, because they would just kill it every night. And they would go out there every night, and they would be so earnest and so thoughtful. He's so smart, and he has a twist on funny. Everything that he does has a different twist to it. It goes to the next level. It's the unexpected. You think it's going to go one way, it completely goes another way.
I'm going to throw out some other names, all right? And
okay.
Any impression comes to you. It could be a word, it could be a story, whatever. Chris Farley.
Sweet and tender-hearted and unsure of himself.
Tina Fey.
Wicked smart. Wicked funny.
Adam McKay.
Adam McKay, right. So him and Tom Janis had a great relationship, creating a lot of shows here. He's such an innovator, so smart, real satire.
And a real leader.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's one of his strengths,
yes,
too. Adie Bryant.
Oh, Adie, you know, Adie, we didn't know Adie that well when we hired Adie Bryant, but she was the it girl in town and was doing a lot of great work. And so she was hired, not sight unseen, but without a lot. She hadn't been with us a long time. So, yeah, she came right to ETC.
Jack McBrayer.
Jack McBrayer. We love Jack McBrayer. You know, Jack calls everybody on their birthday to wish him happy birthday.
You're kidding me.
No, no. He will call. People will get calls. They haven't seen him. And, you know, every year he calls them and he hasn't seen him in like 9 or 10 years. Yeah,
A great episode we just did was with Rachel Dratch. Rachel Dratch.
We love Rachel Dratch. Right,
her.
Right. And I was just reading parts of her book again. I had it at home and it was, and I was laughing at the part where people are like, where are you gone? Where have you gone? You're not doing anything anymore. So smart, so funny, great characters. Audience favorite, always an audience favorite.
Scott Adsit.
Scott Adsit. Well, Scott is he has that comedy genius in him, and I would love to see him do some serious roles because he's a great actor too.
A guy that is by far one of my favorites of all time at Second City, Joe Liss.
Joe Liss, right? So Joe Liss, he's like mercurial. He can transform into a character. He can transform his whole body and become a different character.
We talked about Steve Colbert, Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell.
The ultimate straight man. He's the ultimate. They came and they did Maya, a fairly...
Tell us a little about Maya for people who don't know.
Yeah, Maya is a scene where Stephen Colbert and Steve Carell, Stephen Colbert goes home to his home, his southern hometown, and when he's there, he transforms into an elderly black woman. And he does this with his voice and with his body, and Steve Carell is behind him the whole time, like trying to get up to speed on what's going on in different characters are coming in, and they're treating Stephen Colbert as an old black woman, and then we have somebody come in and they're being really mean to Stephen, and this is the moment when Carell turns and buys into it and starts yelling at him not to treat her like that, and it's so smart and so well paced, and they did it at the 50th, and they were talking backstage about, oh, they hadn't done it in years, and they were like, oh, this scene really stands up, this is a really good scene, and it's so funny because it's such a classic here, we love it so much. And they were revisiting it in that way of like how important it was and how well it stands up.
Bonnie Hunt.
Oh, right, Bonnie Hunt. I think that she's a force, you know what I mean? That she's created a lot of stuff outside of here and is really a force.
Mike Myers.
Mike Myers, really innovative with his characters, was kind of quiet when he was here.
And, you know, the other thing is didn't have a good time, as
no.
I remember, because Canadians, I don't know if this is, well, it doesn't happen as much. When Canadians would come down from Second City, they kind of got, they didn't get great treatment from the cast here.
Well, that's not true. Lauren Ash came down. She got great treatment. We loved her. And I think that he was going through personal stuff. I know his father had died during mm-hmm. that time. And I think that, so that's reflected in your work.
Mm-hmm. Did we leave anybody out? I mean, there's a lot of people, you know. Is there anyone of you guys' names you?
Jimmy Crane.
Jimmy Crane, yeah.
Very funny. Little neurotic.
A little
neurotic. Smart. Knows the work. Has a love of the work. And a deep understanding of the work.
Great. We'll end there because I don't think you can top
no,
me.
No, I can't.
You
can't
top
more
me.
No, I can't.
We end the podcast the same way. What one piece of advice would you give to somebody starting out in improv today?
Train with the best people and take the notes they give you. Yeah.
Allison Riley, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Allison Riley, as well as the Second City Training Center and Jesse Swanson. My producer, Dan Schiffmacher as well, and Sam Bowers, the director. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv workshops, classes, and intensives called The Art of Slow Comedy. And to sign up for my Improv Nerd newsletter, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media. Like our Improv Nerd Facebook page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. And please sign up, subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you'll see clips from our live shows. Also, we are so fortunate to be part of feralaudio.com, some of the most innovative and hilarious podcasts out there. If you want to help this podcast and all the other Feral Audio podcasts, go to feralaudio.com. When you're ordering something from Amazon, hit the buy button. There's a little portal, and we get a couple pennies our way, and it helps keep this podcast going. That is it. I want to thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, walk. Don't
let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I'd love having you